Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
Mama had to get away, spare herself a little shame, just enough to get by, just enough to get by. A lonely, lovely little girl, born into a broken world, just enough to get by, just enough to get by.
That's Kaneen Pipkin of The Lone Bellow, a Brooklyn-based band, singing a song she wrote straight from the heart, a song about her mother, a song about a secret and its aftermath. This is a story about the complex legacy of what we hide and the remarkable beauty that can emerge when what has been hidden is brought to light. I'm Dani Shapiro, and this is Family Secrets, the secrets that are kept from us, the secrets we keep from others, and the secrets we keep from ourselves. Tell me about the landscape of your childhood. Where did you grow up? What was it like?
I grew up in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is a smallish town, I would say, midway between Washington, D.C. and Richmond, Virginia. We learned a lot of Civil War history. I used to do my cross-country practices in trails that ran through the battlefield. So there was a lot of ghosts present, I guess.
Were you aware of that? Did you have that sense at the time?
Oh, absolutely. Virginia is just it's an interesting place. It's kind of a haunted place. And I think I was always really interested in history, not just American history, but world history in general. So it was a rich place to grow up. When I was about 10 years old, my parents co-founded an intentionally cross-cultural church that focused on, and still focuses on, racial reconciliation, because at that point, Fredericksburg was still, I would say, fairly segregated, culturally especially. And I think some people just really wanted to do the work of listening. And so I've been thinking a lot about that with recent events, and just how when we started the church, we were singing, you know, gospel music in the attic of this bluegrass music shop. That is the landscape of my childhood right there. And I think a lot of how I became the kind of musician that I am today.
Brothers and sisters?
Oh yeah, I'm the fourth of five siblings, five Donahue siblings. And there's kind of a big gap between me and my older brother. And so me and my younger brother were kind of like the little kids. And then the three older were like the older kids.
And tell me about your mom.
My mom, her name is Sharon. She is, be she little, she be fierce, or whatever that Shakespeare line is. She's petite, and she dresses in jewel tones. but she grew up near St. Louis and then in Omaha. So she's from Omaha. And she was the oldest of 10 kids. Kind of a genius, I would say. Could beat anybody at Trivial Pursuit. Could answer almost every Jeopardy question immediately. That kind of thing. But definitely shy.
Kaneen's mom and dad met in the early 1970s. Her parents were pretty different from each other, a case of opposites attract. Her dad was outgoing, extroverted, and had a gift for enthusiasm. He loved to travel, meet people, get to know people, and just kind of figure out what makes them tick. Kaneen's mom was much more introverted. As a child, Kaneen found her kind of opaque. She definitely got the sense that there was a lot about her mom that she didn't know.
She didn't really talk to me about things the way that some of my other friends' moms would. And some of my other friends would say that their moms were like their best friend or, you know, their confidant. And I think I always got the impression that my mom was just like busy. I knew she loved us and she was an amazing mom, but she was busy, you know. But as I got older, I kind of perceived that there might be a little more to what I perceived as isolation.
After she graduates from college, Kaneen makes plans to move to China, and her parents take her to the airport to see her off. And her mother, well, her mother just falls apart.
I remember my mom at the airport, like at the Archer's Gate at Dulles, and she just broke down. She was weeping. And honestly, I was pretty confused because I was like, I don't really think you needed me that much. I we always had like a close relationship. I love my mom and she's very caring, but like, I never saw myself as that important. Not in a bad way, but just, I guess I just didn't think she would be that effective if I left.
Had you gone away to college?
Yeah, I went to College of William and Mary, but it's only about, at most, a 2-hour drive.
Right, so the difference between being a 2-hour drive away and being on the other side of the world.
Yeah, and I think it was, and I had taken trips, like I had gone, I'd been to India, and I had spent a summer in China the year before, and I'd always liked to travel. And I had spent the entire summer before I moved to China. I did like a classic backpacking trip with my younger brother and two of my friends. So I was gone a lot. And I hadn't really spent significant time at home since I had graduated from high school. And so, yeah, I guess I was just confused. Like, we didn't have long conversations on the phone ever. I just felt like there wasn't a lot of openness or vulnerability in our relationship.
So what did you make of it at the time?
It made me feel guilty for leaving. And it made me feel like maybe my mom needed me and I wasn't sure why, really. It was confusing, but I just, you know, I had a lot on my mind. I was moving to Asia and, you know, I had a lot to get started. So I think I just kind of, I buried it and I tried to be as good of a long distance daughter as I could be. I tried to write long emails home, and this was way before Zoom. This was the Skype days. So I used to Skype a lot and, you know, just try to let them into my world. But it was just kind of surprising.
So you go off to China, and how long do you stay there before you return to the States?
I was there off and on for about 4 years, I think. Came home for a few months to get married while having some visa trouble. And actually, my mom was like, I was already engaged, and we had been planning on being engaged for like a year and a half, which sounded like a good idea at the time. and then my mom was like, why don't you just stay here for a few months, stay home for a few months and plan the wedding and get married. So that's what we did.
After they were married, Kanine and her husband returned to China, but they started growing restless. They had good jobs that were paying the bills, but they found themselves wondering what their next step might be. They thought about graduate school, coming back to the States. But then Kanine meets a family that had adopted 5 Chinese kids, all of whom had special needs. They ran an orphanage and supported the orphanage with a bread baking business. They also trained the kids who were able to bake so that they'd have skills. This family and their enterprise really lights Kanine up. So she decides to go to culinary school and become a pastry chef.
I knew a lot of people who were doing kind of microfinance, job training, skill training type stuff for different populations. And so I had always loved baking, and I started to think about maybe going to chef school so I could come back and, you know, teach or, I don't know, see what happened with that. But I didn't want to rush into it, so my husband and I both decided we would do this really long fast. I think it was either 30 or 40 days, just like a juice fast.
30 or 40 day juice fast.
Yeah. You know, why not?
Want to make sure I heard that right.
I know, right? It just seemed like such a huge decision. I just wanted to make sure I was like emotionally and mentally and spiritually just clear to make it. So about halfway through that fast, my mom calls me. And so I'm already kind of on this like weird journey, in this like plane of existence that already feels kind of like Kairos time, just like this amplified time of importance. And my mom calls me kind of out of the blue, and she's like, hey, I need to tell you something. And she's like, they found my baby.
Let's just stop there for a sec. Think about this. Imagine being in the middle of a month-long juice fast and hearing these words, they found my baby. I think you might feel like you are hallucinating.
And obviously that sentence didn't make any sense to me at the time. And I asked her to explain, like, what do you mean? And she went on to tell me that my aunt had been Googling their maiden name, which is kind of a unique name, and had found someone posting on a site of people trying to find their birth parents, that this was their birth name, and she just knew it was my mom's child. I remember my mom called me because she was calling all of her kids to kind of ask our permission to get in contact with her child. And I just remember being like, you obviously don't need my permission, but I mean, I'm glad you are telling us this. And I remember my mom not being able to say the word rape when she was telling me about the child. She told me she had been assaulted. And all this was kind of coming out as I'm kind of the way I'm telling it to you now, just lots of random details. She had not dealt with the trauma of it. And then so I was able to finally piece together that she had been raped and had gotten pregnant from the encounter, and then had kind of been sent away to have my half-sister. And I'm still not totally sure as to why.
So Kanine is halfway around the world, in Beijing. She's 25 years old. She hasn't eaten solid food in a while. And now she discovers the source of that opacity she had always sensed in her mother, the source of her mother's slight remove. So you're 24, 25 years old. What are you making of this as you're getting these disjointed details?
I mean, it's completely overwhelming. I immediately am starting to think about different things from my past, the ways that I was raised, the ways that my parents would react to certain things that would happen, or things in the news, or just as I was growing older, the way they would deal with me. And just the way that my mom was, it felt like a lot of things started to make sense. But also, you know, my mom was barely able to even tell me what had happened at this point. And so I felt very overwhelmed, but I felt really grateful that I had randomly read Alice Siebold's memoir called Lucky, which is about when she was raped as a young college student. And she kind of goes into the gritty detail right off the bat of like everything that happens, and then the whole book is her dealing with it. And so I had just read this book really by chance, and I felt like I had been prepared for this phone call in a strange way, and was able to kind of care for my mom a little bit better, I think, and ask better questions.
Did your mind go back to that moment in the airport when you were this very young woman leaving and going, you know, halfway across the world?
It definitely did. And I was able to talk to my mom about that later when talking to her about her own past. And she just said that I had always been just a calming presence to her. And she could just really feel that I cared about her and that I loved her and that I was for her. And she said sometimes that was just like difficult for her to feel about most people. And I don't know if it's just my style of communicating or something else, but that felt like a gift, you know, when someone tells you that they really feel loved by you. That's a special thing, because that's something that you can't really control.
I'm gathering that she made that same phone call to each one of your siblings. And it also, it's interesting because it sounds like she didn't have to. I've heard a lot of stories where, in a way, someone's hand is forced because, you know, someone has come forward and made themselves known and the story is going to come out. This wasn't a story that was going to come out. You know, your aunt doing that research and finding that name and seeing that it must be your mother's child, it sounds like it opened something up in your mother of, I can't just put this back in the box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she was definitely offered the can of worms and given the choice, open it or don't. And I'm really proud of her that she did. I think she saw it for what it was, an opportunity to heal and to deal with some things that had not been dealt with, and to connect with someone that she thought she had lost. It was supposed to be a closed adoption, but they mistakenly put my mother's maiden name on the file. And so that was how my half-sister found her. So I think my mom really had never thought it would be a possibility. And then I think it just felt like a second chance against all the odds.
When your mom told you, it was with a sense that she was interested in knowing more, reaching out. I mean, what happened next?
So felt like it happened pretty quickly. I think they had a phone call, and then I remember I got to the States maybe a month or two later, and my little brother and I and my mom and dad went to Omaha to meet Dory, my half-sister, and her family. And my dad and mom went and had dinner with her one night, and then my little brother and I joined the next day, and we went to the zoo with Dory and her family. She has three kids.
Imagine walking past a group of people at the zoo. An older couple, several younger women and men, some kids, just a family having an outing, just like everybody else, right? Except all families have stories, and sometimes these stories are secrets and require love, patience, care, compassion when these stories begin to be told.
It was a lot for them both, and I think it was just the beginning of what ended up being a really long process for both of them. And I know a lot more about my mom's side of the process than Dory's, but the beginning of kind of being able to go back and work through the trauma. It was amazing because it was this opportunity to meet her and see her as this fully formed, like, beautiful woman. She looks more like my mom than any of the siblings do, any like me or any of my siblings do. And she has this beautiful family. She had just had these two twin boys. And I don't know, she's a real like concrete person with a life. And I think that was incredibly helpful for my mother to see. And then once she could see that, she could go back and deal with the pain that was the genesis of this beautiful life, you know.
The idea that, you know, we are not the pain that has formed us.
Yeah, exactly.
Had your mother told your father about her history?
Yeah, he had known, but he doesn't really like to talk about stuff. He had a pretty rough upbringing. So he's very sensitive. He's very sweet. But he can be a little inaccessible as well, emotionally sometimes.
But it wasn't a surprise to him.
No, he knew about it.
Because that would have been an even more different story, right?
Absolutely.
We'll be back in a moment with more Family Secrets. Now Kanin is back in the States. She's training to be a chef. She's singing on the side. She's always been a singer. And one day, she fills in for a friend who needs help with a gig. And something happens, some kind of kismet, some kind of magic when their voices blend together. You can't force this stuff. You can't make it happen. But when it does, it's unmistakable.
The juice, yeah.
The juice. So at that point, you started Lone Bellow and you were like, this is a thing and we're doing this.
It took a little while for it to kind of solidify into the format it is today. So my bandmates are named Zach and Brian, and they had both been pursuing their own music careers for a long time. And my husband and I had done, my husband's name is Jason. Jason and I had done a lot of gigs when we were in China. We had an agent who would get us these like bonkers gigs at like, I don't know, the opening of a future apartment complex or like super bizarre. Jason once marched in a parade wearing a Swedish flag. It was very strange. And we had a lot of our own music and stuff, but we had never really thought about doing it professionally. It was always just a lot of fun, a hobby, something we love doing. So when I got to New York and I was going to pastry chef school in Manhattan, I ended up singing with Zach, filling in for somebody, and he just like knew immediately. He was like, I want you to be in a band with me. And then randomly one day when I was filling in at a show of his, Brian, our other bandmate, got on stage, and it was when the three of us sang together, we all just felt it. I love singing with them, and it's so much fun. But it really hijacked my plan of going back to China and becoming a pastry chef. And there was a kind of a moment where Jason and I had to decide if we were going to try to stay in the States and do the band, or if we were going to move back. And, you know, what I always say is no one ever gets that opportunity and says, I'll be in a band when I'm older. So we decided to, you know, go for it. We recorded our first record summer of 2011, and it came out January 2013. So it was about, you know, a couple years in the making.
I find myself connecting that, like that sort of that magic that happened on stage and the sort of accidental, random nature of like you, the three of you ending up on the same stage at the same time singing with your reading the Alice Siebold, you know, random and yet totally shapes what happens next.
Absolutely.
I mean, one of the things that I was really struck by is your song, Just Enough to Get By. There's this lyric, it's the chorus, if silence is golden, I know a lot of wealthy women buying what's sold to them, buying anything but freedom. And I understand it to be a song that you wrote about your mother's experience, maybe for your mother. How has this discovery in your life, how has it played into your artistic process, the expression that you do as a songwriter, as a musician?
You know, that song was really a long time coming. I'd heard Brian singing this little melody, just enough to get by, kind of loungy. And I think he was like thinking about drinking or smoking or something. And it was weird because it was kind of a jolly sounding melody. But as soon as I heard it, I thought about my mom. And I think at this point, it had been a couple years and she had been doing this work and I'd been keeping up with her progress, like going to a counselor and kind of trying to work through everything. And I was really proud of her for being willing to go back to that place. And she told me that her one counselor had her imagined when she had to walk through it, that someone was with her. And she said she always imagined it was me, that I was like standing with her, walking with her through the experience. I felt very honored to be that kind of presence in my mom's life and in her recovery. And I think it just made me want to put myself in her shoes and allow myself to kind of feel my own feelings about all of it. And she was doing the work of going through all that emotional trauma. And I think it made me want to write about things in a way that would help other people who felt alone and who felt isolated by their own secrets and by the shame we put on ourselves when things beyond our control have happened to us. And yeah, that song, I wrote it kind of all in an afternoon in the van. And I was just really in my feelings. And it was a very cathartic, very like swift lyrical process. It kind of just all came out. And my bandmates really liked it, but I didn't feel ready to sing it.
So Kaneen puts the song away, just tucks it away. But of course, it doesn't actually go away. She's a little afraid of it, not sure what to do with it. But a year later, during the start of the Me Too movement, suddenly she knows it's time.
I was like, oh, damn, I think I'm ready to sing this. I think I'm ready to do it. But I had to make sure that my mom was okay with it because I didn't want to. She was still pretty private about what had happened. And I was very sensitive. And I think that song to me is a very honest reflection that just because you're dealing with something doesn't mean it works out in a very neat and orderly way. It's not a Hallmark movie ending. It's messy, you know. It's difficult. It's heartbreaking. And it's not just like, I got raped and I had a child and now we're best friends and everything is great and I love talking about it. That's definitely not that's not how it works out. It's not how it shakes out. So there was a lot of frustration in me seeing that people were trying to get her to talk about it before she was ready and get her to kind of spin it into this thing that it wasn't. So I was very sensitive.
We like neat and tidy narratives that we can tie up in a bow.
Yeah. Yeah. So I knew it wasn't that. So I wanted the song to kind of have this unease to it and kind of have cathartic feeling, but also just an honest feeling of like, I don't really know how this ends.
What was your mother's response when you worked up the courage to, you know, take her the song and show her what you'd written?
She liked it. She was very encouraging about it. And I was nervous as hell. I was shaking in my boots, taking it to her. Because I just didn't, you know, I didn't want to feel like I was, like, voyeuristic or, I don't know, just being like, I used your pain to make art. Aren't you proud of me? You know, I think she recognized that I put a lot of myself into that song, too. And she said it was a very accurate portrayal of what she went through. And that took a lot of weight off my shoulders. And it made me prepared to kind of go to bat for the song and make it as good as it could be.
What's it been like to perform the song?
It's been awesome.
Is there anything different about it than performing your other songs that are maybe a little bit less loaded?
I can definitely see some people getting a little uncomfortable. And I've had people write me or people come up to me after the show and tell me their stories, which are in some way similar to my mom's. And that's been everything, you know. That's all I've really desired, is that it's just a helpful thing for people.
We're going to take a quick break here for a word from our sponsor. If there's one thing I've learned from hosting this podcast, it's that when there are secrets, there is almost always shame, a drumbeat beneath. That's why the secret's being kept. And then the shame has its own legacy. It works on people. We know something isn't right, but we can't put our finger on it. Then sometimes we have an opportunity to take that legacy of shame and make something that reaches and helps other people and explodes the shame by naming it.
I'm just so indebted to my sister Dory, my half-sister Dory, and my mom for just really being willing to do the work of bringing it into the light, talking about it. And I think their bravery and just willingness to go somewhere uncomfortable and willingness to be honest and transparent I feel like it really has unlocked something in me. And I think specifically growing up with that secret, not knowing about it, my parents were pretty overprotective, I would say. And I think I felt a lot of shame just like being a woman. And I kind of felt like I was suspect of a lot of things. And I think once I had known about my mom, it just made sense. It made sense why they were protective. But it also kind of freed me from thinking that I had something to do with it. You know what I mean? I was a good kid, you know, like boring in that way. And so I always felt pretty frustrated that I felt like my parents didn't trust me. And I think now the lesson that has taught me is just with my own son, I think about ways that I can be honest and open with him and that I can give him the gift of like my transparency and my story.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about exactly that, because I think becoming a mother, becoming a parent, tends to make us reflect back on how we were children and how we were parented and the things that we carried or the legacy of that. And, you know, the pendulum swings and swings again.
And your son is how old?
He'll be 3 next week.
So I have, one last question for you. As you think about this, as you think about everything that has transpired since that first phone call when you were in your mid-20s, are you glad that all this came out?
Absolutely. 100%. Because I've gained a sister, and I can see the freedom it's brought my mom at a great cost, for sure. But there's something unspeakably good about a life and a beautiful person who you love coming out of such a tragedy. And it just feels like a gift that there should be any good that comes out of it at all. But I think it has helped me understand my mother and understand what a lot of women have been through so much more. And that's all I really want in life, is to understand people better, you know?
That's beautiful, Kaneen. Thank you so much. Family Secrets is an iHeartMedia production. Dylan Fagan is the supervising producer, and Beth Ann Macaluso is the executive producer. We'd also like to give a special thanks to Tyler Klang and Tristan McNeil. If you have a family secret you'd like to share, leave us a voicemail, and your story could appear on an upcoming episode. Our number is 1-888-SECRET-0. That's secret and then the number 0. You can also find us on Instagram at Danny Writer, and Facebook at facebook.com/FamilySecretsPod, and Twitter at FamSecretsPod.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.